the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, coming to you live today from Princeton, New Jersey. It's a spectacular fall day here in Princeton, and what a place of history, and just a magnificent day, and the city of one of America's great universities. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. The topic of today has to do with our voting and what we are actually doing when we vote. Drew Weston is a professor at Emory University in Atlanta, and he argues that most Americans vote out of emotion. Similar arguments are made by those who write books with titles such as The Myth of the Rational Voter, suggesting that actually a very small minority of Americans actually think through the issues, actually vote on the basis of a clear set of convictions and political analysis. The vast majority of Americans, a growing consensus of observers suggests, vote on the basis of how they feel, on how they feel a personal connection with a particular candidate or the lack of a connection with another, how they feel in terms of the use of language. Today's edition of the New York Times has a fascinating article about Drew Weston, this professor at Emory University. He is credited in this argument, in this article, that is, with helping Democrats to reframe their arguments, with helping Democrats to use a different language that reaches emotional levels of voters in terms of the electorate, shaping and attracting voters to an argument that, phrased even slightly differently, might go a different direction. We're going to be looking at that argument, and I want to ask you today, as you think about joining the conversation, do you believe that you and your neighbors are actually deciding on the basis of a rational analysis how to vote? Or do you think that most Americans vote on the basis of emotion? Admit it or not, emotion's a big part of our lives. Drew Weston and many others in the field of political science now believe that it is the main driver behind voting patterns, not reason. You know, what this comes down to is the fact that you look at a phenomenon like the political debates between the presidential candidates, a growing number of observers say it really doesn't matter what they say, it matters how they say it. It really doesn't matter what their policy positions are, it matters how they connect with an audience and how people perceive their arguments to be either attractive or unattractive. And that not so much as at an intellectual, but at an emotional level. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I'd love to hear from you because I think this is where intelligent Christians need to think intelligently. Are we, and are our neighbors for that matter, actually voting on the basis of some kind of rational calculation? Or is this basically about emotion? Is this basically about likes and dislikes and comfort and discomfort? When it comes to emotion, it's sometimes hard to even know how to put all this into words. Drew Weston at Emory University is working with the Democrats to help them put their message into words. And it looks like at least many of the candidates that he is working with are finding a winning strategy as they are now favored to win come next Tuesday. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We are live today from Princeton, New Jersey. And we were walking around the campus today. It is a spectacular fall day here in Princeton. And when you think about American history, American theology, American politics, Princeton is ground zero for so much of this in the intellectual life of the nation. We enjoyed walking around the campus, seeing the historic sites, and it's just impossible. It's just impossible when you're walking around a campus like this not to realize the culture-shaping impact of some of these massive institutions. A lot of people just would not remember that, of course, Princeton University has a deep heritage in American evangelical tradition. That both the university here and the seminary, and they're now independent of each other, located very, very close together, that they emerged out of the Presbyterian tradition. They have great impact from the First Great Awakening. You're looking at buildings named for people like Jonathan Edwards, Alexander, John Witherspoon. It's a fascinating assemblage of buildings and of memories and monuments on a campus. Of course, this university was also the institution where Woodrow Wilson served as president before running for governor of New Jersey and then being elected president of the United States. It was here in the Institute for Advanced Studies that Albert Einstein found his academic home. And walking around the streets of Princeton, New Jersey, you can still see some of the ghosts, so to speak, in terms of the names that are on the streets and the monuments and, of course, just the knowledge that this is the place where so many of these things happened. But when you are talking about, the city of Princeton, much less the university, you're talking about a place that shaped millions of lives indirectly, thousands of lives directly. And it is a reminder to those of us who are Christians that these great centers of intellectual learning and of academia are places which are very important mission fields, because here minds and lives are being molded. And it's impossible to be here and not to have that very much in mind. There's a lot going on in the news. USA Today has an editorial out opposing Proposition 8 in California. It does run a companion piece supporting Proposition 8. But one of the arguments used by USA Today's editors is this. It says, polls show that successive generations have tended to be more accepting of homosexuality. So time might favor an eventual acceptance of gay marriage. Regardless, the state's responsibility is to protect their citizens' rights no matter how their relationships are labeled. You know, that's really, really interesting, because if you just take that concluding paragraph, you know good and well that the editors of USA Today can't live with this logic. They have established here a policy. They establish it as a matter of principle. They say that because society might become more accepting about gay marriage, that we have to point public policy in that direction. Well, what about other things that the society might become more tolerant or accepting of? Are we just to assume that whatever society accepts as more acceptable is the direction public policy ought to point us? I don't think they can live with that principle. And the second sentence was this: regardless, the state's responsibility is to protect their citizens' rights no matter how their relationships are labeled. Oh, really? You see, I don't think they mean that. I think they mean you now include homosexual couples along with heterosexual couples, but let's not fool ourselves. That hardly limits the range of possibilities here. When you start thinking about the range of possible couplings or unions, it goes far beyond this. But to follow the logic of USA Today's editors, you can't worry about how the relationships are labeled. You simply have to recognize them all as legitimate. Again, when you start to see in the media arguments being made as matters of principle, and you know good and well those principles can't be applied except in a very narrow case, then you know you have a problem. It's an intellectual problem. And for those pushing same-sex marriage, it is a basic and very fundamental intellectual problem. They are claiming that marriage can be one other thing than what it's always been. One other thing. And they're saying it's ridiculous to say that once you accept it as one other thing, you have to accept that it might be even yet other things. But as a very credible legal scholars have pointed out, the moment you say that marriage is no longer to be defined by gender, then you really lose all credibility to say that it should be defined by number. Why not polygamy? Why not any number of other relationships? I mean, after all, USA Today says there are only two principles. And the first principle is that society might become more accepting. Well, society might well become more accepting of anything in the future. It also says the state has to protect citizens' rights, that's the way it puts it, no matter how relationships are labeled. I don't think they really mean that either. I think they just want same-sex marriage. That's it. They just want what those pushing that agenda demand. And they're willing to try to come up with some arguments for it on the other side. We need to be praying for the people of Pakistan. A quake there has left about 15,000 homeless, and reports are something around 200 dead, and it looks like that number could rise significantly. The quake is measured with a magnitude of 6.4, and news reports are indicating that that quake, though not particularly strong, has had a tremendous effect because of the density of the people and the flimsiness of the housing. And so much like the Sichuan province earthquake that happened just a few months ago, here you have a massive disaster that is made more massive by the fact that all these people are congregated together and with construction procedures and processes that really mean that many of these buildings come down rather quickly. We need to be praying for people in Pakistan as they are suffering in light of this loss. The USA Today is also out with some very interesting data looking at the election, suggesting, of course, that there may be a new pattern in the electorate, that electorate perhaps moving from a center-right to a center-left direction. That'll be interesting conversation for us in the future. After the election, we're looking back. What does the election mean about the trajectory of America? Something else about trajectory that comes very interesting. Whenever you have, for instance, a church that takes a very clear position on an issue, and then you have institutions that rebel against it, you have a problem. The New York Times is out with a story indicating that the Cardinal Archbishop of New York, Edward Egan, is very upset with Fordham University for its decision to give an award on human rights to Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. It's a Catholic issue, but it has extensions far beyond Catholicism. The Archbishop is saying, look, what sense does it make to give an award on human rights to a man who doesn't believe that unborn infants have human rights? It's another reminder to us that often academic institutions lead the way in pulling churches and Christian institutions away from cherished principles. I think this Archbishop is right to be outraged, and I think a further outrage is it isn't only in Catholic institutions where these kinds of atrocities happen. Let me ask you, is your response to these issues primarily rational or emotional? Call me at 877-893-8255 and tell me. We'll be right back with Intelligent Christian Conversation on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, being in a place like Princeton, New Jersey, surrounded by Princeton University and all the bookstores and libraries and associated institutions that are located here, it's easy to think that most people operate on a rational basis. But, you know, even the people who are teeming the halls of Princeton University, who are sitting in the classrooms and are teaching in the classrooms, they're not only rational people, they are also emotional people. And sometimes we are a mystery to ourselves. When we like something, when we dislike something, when we are drawn to someone or not drawn to someone, is it for rational reasons? Is it because of ideas? Or is it simply because of some kind of emotional response? A growing body of literature suggests that when it comes to political science and the behavior patterns of the electorate, most people are voting on the basis of something other than rational calculation. As a matter of fact, Brian Kaplan has written a book entitled The Myth of the Rational Voter, and he suggests that the reason why voters often vote on the basis of emotion is because reality never gets checked for them, and being wrong is never costly. If they're wrong when they buy a car, if they're wrong when they take a job, if they're wrong when they make other kinds of decisions, primarily economic decisions, then they understand that they lose by being wrong. If they make a bad deal, they lose. But when it comes to politics, he suggests, the matters are of public policy are now so complicated that voters never know if they get it wrong. But they just go on hunches and likes, and this, he suggests, is a threat to democracy itself. He talks about the myth of the rational voter, and there's sometimes, I think, most of us looking at our neighbors wonder if that might not be right. But there's more to it than that, of course. Drew Weston, an article about him in today's New York Times suggests that he has been very effective in helping Democrats to focus on a new re-messaging program to reach out to the electorate using emotional language. For instance, instead of saying that one would allow recent illegal immigrants to work towards registration and a basic pattern of gaining citizenship, they would change the word allow to require. Evidently, voters like the word require better than the word allow. Certainly you see subtle changes in even abortion arguments and other things where people are just shifting the language a little bit when actually the policies could be reversed without having to reverse the language. If you're simply going to operate on the basis of emotions, finding words that find resonance and seem to connect with people. I want to ask you the question. We got callers on the line. We're going to get to those calls right now, but you can join the conversation by calling me at 877-893-8255. Do you think most people are voting on rational or on emotional terms? Let's go to Branson, Colorado. Michael's listening on KGFT. What do you think, Michael?
Hey, thank you very much for your show, Albert Mueller. And I think it's more based on an emotional deal, based on the fact that we are in the flesh, according to the Word. And instead of standing on the Word and listening to the Word, we're more apt to vote based on our emotions.
Yeah, and you see that. Do you feel the tug of that yourself, Michael, or do you see it as more related to what people you observe?
Well, more and more as this election gets closer and closer and listening to the opposing views, anytime someone as a Christian stands and says, this is what God says, you get more people angry about the fact that they say, Barack Obama stands for abortion or whatever the case may be. And the minute you say, well, that's against God's word, but yet he says he's a Christian, it brings out all the fire and all the fury of different individuals. And I'm just noticing more and more that it's more of an emotional diss than it is more so what God has asked us as Christians to do.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate the call, Michael, and I think what we're discovering is emotions do play a really big part. I think we have to formulate that in our calculations. You know, and it's not just about politics. I think it's about virtually any responsibility or arena of life. We know that people are not just rational. They are also emotional, and that really does tend to complicate things sometimes. When it comes to voting, that can be downright scary. Let's go to Tyrone, Pennsylvania. Norm's listening on WTLR. What are you thinking, Norm?
I tend to agree that I use a rational approach on an emotional issue. I vote primarily based on abortion, which means that if somebody doesn't support the unborn who can't stand for themselves, then I won't trust them for anything else. So that's why I vote on abortion all the time.
Norm, I appreciate the call, and I understand your hierarchy of issues there. I frankly agree. And very publicly agree with your hierarchy of issues of starting with life first. But I think the reason why we have lost some ground, perhaps, on that issue is because we have clearly the best arguments. We have the only argument that starts with the basis of any sound grounding of human dignity. That is, in the fact that every single human being at every stage of life from conception to natural death is made in the image of God. But you know, Norm, I really think that perhaps more people have been actually drawn to a pro-life position by seeing those pictures from the womb and ultrasound technology in which the eyes have made an immediate connection with that unborn child, and the basic humanity there has been impossible to deny. I think a lot of people not reached by our rational arguments have been reached by those pictures. And I think that, of course, the whole science of propaganda is how to turn that the other way, and that's what we have to be watchful about. Thanks for your call, Norm. Let's go to Doug, listening on WFIA, calling from Sellersburg, Indiana. What's on your mind, Doug?
Dr. Mueller, I called to say that, first of all, personally, I hope that my vote and my thought process is based on the standard of God's Word first, knowing that an emotional response, my emotions can trick me. They can cause me to misalign my priorities. But I would agree with the previous caller's assessments that most people are voting primarily on emotion. And I'm wondering if that might not be an outcropping of the slide of absolute truth in our society, that there is no absolute truth, so that reason will fail us and emotion is all that they think they have left.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in what you have to say there, Doug, and I appreciate you saying that your rational basis of voting is principally based upon the Word of God. But that just underlines the fact that you really have to put thought into it, doesn't it? I mean, if you're going to vote in a way that is consistent with biblical truth, you're going to have to, first of all, know what that truth is. Secondly, you're going to have to be able to translate the Word of God into actual decision-making on your part. And that requires more than evidently some of our neighbors and even fellow Christians are willing to put into this. And I think it also requires us in our honesty. And I would say that to all the callers and to all of us who are thinking here. You know, at times we're not even sure until we really go to a second level of thinking where we analyze our thinking. We're not even sure why we like or dislike some things. And that's why, for instance, you can show the same picture or you can tell the same story to two or three different people. They'll respond in different ways. Well, if it's just art, that may not matter all that much. But if it is, if it's then to be translated into the question of what we do now, boy, it can matter a great deal. There are likes and dislikes. There are words that grate on some people and attract others. But the whole science behind what Drew Weston and others are doing, and Drew Weston teaches at Emory University, the New York Times has a big story about him. I've read his book that is mentioned here. He is also really working at the science of what is called messaging. And what's interesting here is that he and others from the field of psychiatry and psychology are using brain tracking wave energy, brain activity tracking kinds of technologies to show how certain parts of the brain light up when certain words are used and fail to light up when other words are used. Well, that's pretty manipulative, but it's a science, and it's a science being used right now to those who would shape a political message. I think it's important that we know this. And I think it's also important that we realize that some words, and it's not just one candidate and one party about this, this article suggesting the Democrats are better at it right now, but when you look at the political process, how do you know that you're not being manipulated by the strategic use of certain words as code? You know, that's something we better keep in mind. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Call me and tell me what you think. We'll be back with your calls on the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Do you think that you, and perhaps in contrast, your neighbors, think basically in emotional or rational terms when it comes to politics? When you look at the election, by the way, some of the numbers are staggering. Some of the estimations being made by people whose business this is suggests that upwards of 80% of the electorate vote on almost purely emotional bases, leaving only about 10 to 20% of people who are giving some hard thought to how they vote. And some of it, by the way, emotion goes beyond just how they feel emotionally about a candidate or about a party or about positions. Part of it's also peer pressure. Who's voting? Is it cool to vote for this candidate, or is it considered uncool by my peers? Will somebody think more of me if I say I voted this way, or will they think less of me? Emotion operates at so many different levels. I think one of the most important things we as Christians should understand is that emotions are undeniably a part of what it means to be human, but emotions are probably the part of us that we can least trust. Because in our fallenness, our emotions and even our intuitions can be shaped by and drawn to all the wrong things. Give me a call and tell me what you think. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Some go so far as to suggest that the very idea of a rational voter, that is a voter who's really using reason and the powers of the intellect to think things through, they're suggesting it is a myth that indeed democracy is imperiled by the fact that people vote primarily on emotional terms. Now, let me just add a little footnote here. I have some concern about all of this science and data that comes down to the fact it's almost all coming from the left, which is kind of like looking back at some of the books that have been written, such as What's Wrong with Kansas, when liberals say, look, people are voting against their best interest when they support conservative policies. That must be because they're deluded. It must be because someone's reaching them with emotion rather than reason. Sometimes we think anyone who disagrees with us is irrational, so it has to be emotion. So I think we have to put a footnote there, but I think in the big picture, the reality is we all know an awful lot of people in this country vote on the basis of emotion rather than reason. Tell me what you think. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. Stan did from Imler, Pennsylvania. Stan, what do you think?
Well, as we look at the facts that they're presented to us for the candidates and so on, I can't help think we can't eliminate our emotional aspect of it.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. So, you know, how do you factor that in then when you're thinking politically, Stan? I think you're absolutely right. So what do you do about that?
Well, I don't know. That's a hard question to answer. It seems for me in the past elections and this one too that anymore that I vote not necessarily for someone but who I don't want anymore, because I'm not sure I want either candidates anymore.
Yeah, well, that's an honest statement, and, you know, a little bit of honesty can go a long way here. This late in the political cycle, we're all kind of tired of this. We're all ready, I think, for it to be over, but we have a lot at stake in this as well, and that's why we've got to stay in there and keep thinking. But not just thinking in the most crass political terms that you see out there, you know, people trying to gain your attention with messaging, but as we even think about how to think. That puts us perhaps in a minority, according to this research, in a very small number of our fellow citizens who are thinking about thinking, much less thinking about politics. Let's go to Jeff calling from New Albany, Indiana, listening on WFIA. What's on your mind, Jeff?
Good evening. I agree a lot with the last caller about not being for either candidate, but most striking I find the conversation about making judgments based on emotions. I mean, everything that we do is based on emotions. The deep-seated feelings that most Christians have against abortion is directly due to the fact of the way it makes you feel when you think about killing a baby. And so no matter how much hard thought you give something, at the end of the day, it's what that subject makes you feel that best determines the decision that you make.
Okay, listen, a lot of wisdom there. Jeff, hang with me here for a minute if you can stay on the line, because I think that's really, really important. And, you know, it reminds me of something that comes from a very simple source. And is related directly to the gospel. And that was the old drawing that Campus Crusade for Christ used to present. And, you know, here on a university campus, boy, that certainly comes to mind. Campus Crusade for Christ in the Four Spiritual Laws book used to put out a picture of a train. You remember the train? And the train had two cars, facts and feelings. And the question is, which is to come first? You know, and when you're making, a response to the gospel, when you are making some response to the claims of Christ, you know, feeling is very much a part of that. But the feeling has to be based upon the facts that Christ actually did live, that God did send him as his sinless son to die on the cross, that he actually did die as our substitutionary Savior, that he actually was raised from the dead. Those facts have to be true, otherwise the feelings are false. And one of the problems that that little pamphlet was designed to address is the fact that we often are dissuaded and led the wrong way by our feelings, and that's why you got to go back and check the facts. And Jeff, I think you're right. We are emotional people. The so what is, we better really force ourselves to think, to go back to the facts, and make sure our feelings are aligned with reality. You mentioned the issue of abortion. I think you're exactly right. We'll talk more about that when we come right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you live today from Princeton, New Jersey. Let me ask you to enter into a little exercise with me here, and I do not want your answer to this question. You just think about it, all right? So that's not what we want to have calls on, the answer to this question. How do you feel about Senator Barack Obama? Question two, how do you feel about Senator John McCain? You know, I don't respond really well to questions about how I feel because, I don't know, maybe it's just, I'm a little uncomfortable when people press the feel question, and sometimes I want to answer, I feel irritated by your question, that's how I feel. But the reality is that we do have feelings and emotions that relate to these questions, and if we do not recognize them, then we're really lying to ourselves and cutting ourselves off from our own decision-making process because we are, none of us, is as rational as we like to think. The reality is we have likes and dislikes. We have preconceptions and preconditions. We have assumptions and intuitions that play into this, and we have things that are hidden in our memory and embedded in our experience that perhaps aren't even there at the surface where we can articulate them. Why is it you don't like that food? Why is it you associate that food with some bad experience? Why is it you don't like that color? Who was wearing it when you had a bad experience? You know, all these things, it's sometimes beyond our understanding. That's why I think we have to be concerned when we know that there are people who are trying to use psychological tests and psychiatric tests in order to come up with studies of the human brain to see what makes more people think well of a candidate on the basis just of these kinds of signs and words and messaging issues. Let me read to you from the article that is published in today's edition of the New York Times. It says this, and let me remind you, it's talking about Professor Drew Weston, who teaches psychology at Emory University. He's become a major figure in terms of advising Democratic candidates in terms of how to do messaging. This is from a story by Shayla Dewan and Robbie Brown, published in today's edition of the New York Times. Let me read to you here. It says that Drew Weston is about what some Democratic consultants say is the first systematic, data-driven effort to mold the language of the left to fit the sensibilities of the center. So in other words, what they're trying to do is to make middle America feel better about more liberal ideas. That's straightforwardly what they say they're doing. The problem is the way they do it, it's not very straightforward. Dr. Weston's advice, I'm back to reading the article, can be heard when Alicia Thomas Morgan, running for re-election to the Georgia House in a conservative suburb of Atlanta, uses the word leadership in place of government and speaks about the middle class instead of the poor. Now, that's very interesting. So a consultant said, don't say poor, say middle class, because they're more middle class people who are concerned, and their self-interest will come to the fore. They'll feel better about it, like you're talking to them, because they don't think of themselves as poor. That's the kind of argument here. Back to the argument, it says, or when Andrew Gillum, a city commissioner in Tallahassee, Florida, who is fighting a ballot initiative against same-sex marriage, tells people of his predominantly black church of the human desire for dignity and respect instead of lecturing them on the evils of discrimination, end quote. Well, I find that very interesting. You see, by the way, it turns out that the African-American and Latino populations are very conservative on the issue of marriage. They know what marriage is. And those populations and demographics have been pretty resistant to efforts to try to make a one-to-one equivalence between opposition to same-sex marriage and racial discrimination. That's just not selling. It's not working. And the reason it's not working is because people know that they are not the same thing. And so you have this consultant saying, all right, to this candidate in Tallahassee, Florida, don't talk about discrimination. Instead, talk about a desire for dignity. Now, that's emotional in terms of the dynamic there. That's what they're looking for here. Drew Weston, the psychologist at Emory University who is behind this, says that candidates should avoid a lot of detail about public policy and what exactly they will do because the public fundamentally isn't that interested in their positions. They're more interested in hearing what they want to hear. He says, quote, we are a centrist nation, but people prefer center-left to center-right, even in conservative parts of the country, if they hear equally strong messages on both sides. Later in the article, it says, instead of using euphemisms like pro-choice and reproductive health, his handbook suggests that liberal candidates might insist that it is un-American for the government to tell men and women when to start a family or what religious beliefs to follow. Arguments that test well, the article says, in focus groups with conservatives and independents. Very interesting. The phone number to join the conversation in the moments that remain is 877-893-8255. Let's go to John calling from Missouri. John, what do you think?
Thank you for your program, Dr. Mueller. I believe that the fact that there are so many undecided voters at this late stage in the game and so many people that change their mind due to an ad or an interview that they might have seen at this point proves that it is an emotion-driven voting block. And that we as Christians probably should have made our decision long ago. Now, we have emotions about these candidates, but they should be backed up by biblical standards and not just to be changed on a whim.
John, I think you get the award for brilliant insight of the day. I think that's very, very important, and I do think that's a brilliant insight. I think it points out that if so many people are waiting this late to make a decision, then they're not making the decision on the positions because they've been out there for a long time. They're not making decisions based upon what now would be some kind of change in these positions because they've been consistent as we've come to know these candidates and what they represent. I think you're exactly right. And given the percentage of what are estimated to be undecided voters, your insight means we should be pretty scared, pretty much aware and concerned about the nature of the electorate. Because if you haven't decided now, what are you waiting for? And by the way, some of this data that's coming in books like The Myth of the Rational Voter and in the work of Drew Weston and many others is suggesting that a frightening number of voters don't make the decision, or they say they don't make the decision, until they enter the voting booth. Now, to amplify John's point, if you haven't made the decision by then just how intelligent are you in making any decision at all? What's going to happen between when you walk in that booth and the moment before? It's going to tell you something you don't now know. It means that they're looking for some kind of gut reaction, some kind of emotional reaction. It's not rational by definition. And I think because of that, it's just a reminder to us that it's not just when we say, well, others are in this position. We need to make sure that we are not in this position. We are called as Christians to exercise every faculty that our Creator gave us, and Christianity is a way of life that dignifies the life of the mind. It doesn't say that we are saved by reason. It does say that God's given us reason so that we can recognize the truth. It also tells us that we're emotional people and that we have to be very careful to make sure that our emotions are in line with the facts and with our principles and convictions. Not that our principles and convictions are going to bend to our feelings, much less the facts. Facts don't care what you feel about them. But just try telling that to evidently a good number of our neighbors. Back of final thoughts. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're going to take one final caller. Melissa is listening on WFIA. What are you thinking, Melissa?
Oh, I'm just calling to address the comment that the columnist made about the need to address the middle class, and that's something I've noticed in this election, that so prior to this, in elections, working-class people had always been addressed, and middle class had rarely been mentioned, and with this election, there's absolutely no mention of working class whatsoever.
You know, that has been noticed by others. There are some websites, Melissa, that actually post how many times the candidates are using certain terms. especially in the debates. That's where I saw this listing for the first time. And it's very interesting. This is not an illusion. You're absolutely right. That is exactly how both candidates are referring to people in the vast mainstream of the country. They're using the term middle class. By the way, just even fairly recently, that was considered to be language one should not use. And so it's interesting how that has come about. And obviously what they're trying to do, and it's not just one candidate or one party, in a fallen world, it's everybody trying to gain advantage. What they're trying to do is to associate with more people saying, I'm like you, I'm concerned with you. And Melissa, I think there's something going on there. I don't know exactly what that means, except when some people hear working class, my guess is they don't think of themselves in that class. Not that they don't think of themselves as working, but they think of this as probably a labor economy. And my guess is when they hear working class, they're thinking about factory workers and things like that, when they think themselves more engaged in perhaps the knowledge economy. And maybe they would feel left out. So I guarantee you this, and I think that's the point you're making, Melissa. This is not by accident. So something has been calculated here. I've been referring today to the work of Drew Weston at Emory University. You can find the article about him at the New York Times in today's edition. You can also look at his published work. The same thing with the Kaplan work on the myth of the rational voter. You start looking at these things and you realize that those who are trying to sell you something politically, and both of those are really writing for the left, but similarly, there's a lot of messaging going on the right, on the conservative side as well. Those who are trying to sell you something are going to figure out what will pull the trigger for you, what will excite you and gain your attention, what will draw you, attract you, and make you feel more comfortable with making this electoral decision. I think one of the most important things we can do in this program today as intelligent Christians is realize that we are in a battle of ideas that is also, let's admit it, a battle of feelings and a battle of emotions. We're the people who know that that's not by accident. God made us as composite creatures. Emotions are part of what God gave us as a faculty and as a way of knowing ourselves. But in a fallen world, emotions are the least trustworthy part of ourselves, and I think we know that. We've got to go back and check our feelings against the facts. And let's face the truth, we better hope that our neighbors are doing the same things when they go to the polls. It's not just important how you feel, it's important that your feelings follow your convictions and principles. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.